Episode 133 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, before we get started today, I want to thank our sponsors, CME Group, Trading Technologies, and Top Step Trader. Today I spoke to a man who originally went pre-med in college, but changed course and went to business school. He was originally in insurance as a bond manager, then became an equity manager for an equity firm. He then went back to Notre Dame to work in the investment office and endowment management before he went on to work at UNC and their endowment management office. Today, he is the CEO and CIO of Morgan Creek Capital Management. His name is Mark Yusko. Today, Mark and I spoke a lot about managing risk and the importance of being able to move on from bad trades. Mark explains the current overvaluation of equities and how today's generation compares to the times of 1929 and the 1930s. He compares the presidency of Herbert Hoover to that of Donald Trump's. I asked Mark why there's so much talk about Europe being a safe place to invest right now. We then talked about emerging markets. He thinks they're a great investment right now because in the long run, their growth is faster than their PE. I asked Mark about the chances of a recession and when a recession may hit the U.S. We also discussed the business cycle and why Mark thinks that we're at the tail end of it. Finally, he gave us his outlook on oil and how it will have an impact on earnings. I had a lot of fun speaking with Mark, not only because he's knowledgeable, but he holds nothing back when expressing his views. I love his passion for the markets. Thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Mark, welcome to the show.
Anthony, thanks for having me. Enjoy being with you today.
Great to speak with you today, Mark. Now, I've been following you on Twitter for a while. Really outspoken guy. I love you on Twitter. It's great. I also watch you on Real Vision, too. So it's really great to have you on Futures Radio Show today to speak with you about some of these great topics we have. But before we get started, can you please tell us how you got your start in the industry and walk us through your career a bit? Take us through that timeline, Mark, on how you eventually became the CEO and CIO at Morgan Creek Capital Management.
You know, I would say my life is a series of happy accidents, Anthony. You know, I went to school to be an architect, changed to pre-med, graduated with a degree in biology and chemistry, decided I didn't want to be a pharmaceutical sales rep, not tall enough or good looking enough, and so went to business school. And took the first job out of business school, worked for an insurance company as a bond manager, then was an equity manager for an equity firm, and then I got the call. I got the call from the alma mater to go back to Notre Dame and work in the investment office, and that's where I learned about endowment management and why I thought that was really the future of investing for individuals as well as institutions. Did that for 5 years, then had the chance, I was the number two guy there, had the chance to become the number one guy down at University of North Carolina here in Chapel Hill, and did that for 7 years, and then 13 years ago went out on my own and formed Morgan Creek. And you know what's really interesting about investing is people say, well, you know, what is science training, you know, biology and chemistry have to do with investing? And I think it's actually the perfect training, because what do we do? What do you and I do all day? We form a hypothesis, we take a position, we test the hypothesis, we get feedback. Then if we're right, we press the position. If we're wrong, we have to reform the hypothesis, come up with a new way. So I think it's actually the scientific method's really applicable to investing.
Take me back to the earlier times when you were thinking about this, you know, getting involved in the financial markets. I'm always wondering what goes through someone's mind and like what was the moment where you started to like, you know, really say, this is what I want to do now.
Yeah, it's great. I say it's when I went from, you know, a vocation or something that I really wanted to do, like going back to the alma mater, versus something that I wanted to do for a living, to your point. And it was interesting. You know, when I was working for the insurance company as a bond manager, it was fine, right? You know, we bought and sold bonds. We worked with some external bond managers. I like to say I hired Dan Fuss from Loomis Sayles before he was famous. And then I went to an equity firm. And look, there are five of us working for this firm. It's founded by two professors out of Northwestern. We had $1 billion back when $1 billion was a lot of money. And we picked securities based on the value methodology, low price to book, quantitative investing. You know, that was pre-PCs, so we're doing it on the VAX computer at Northwestern University. And that was all great, but I didn't have a calling for it. But when I went back to Notre Dame, I realized that, you know, preserving capital that people give you, okay, when people make gifts to the university, took a different approach. It wasn't all about return. It was about managing risk. And what I just became really enamored with this whole idea of diversifying a portfolio, looking at different sectors, looking at private markets, real estate, commodities, stocks, bonds, hedge funds, and putting that all together in a portfolio. And that's when I really had a calling. And that's what I've been doing for the last 20 plus years.
I love how you said it's the moment that you realize it was managing risk. It's funny for me, the first couple of years I started in this business, it was nothing but pain. I lost money, struggled. All I tried to do was make money. When I started to learn that this business was about managing risk, I felt so much more focused, so much more at ease. The pressure was off, and I just felt so much more in tune with what I was doing.
Oh, it's so true. Look, if you know, the old saw is if you take care of the losses, the gains take care of themselves. And you know, George Soros has the great line, "I'm only rich because I admit my mistakes faster than everybody else." You know, Peter Lynch talks about, you know, human condition is people want to pull their flowers, so they want to take their gains quickly because they're afraid they're going to lose them, and they water their weeds, and they're afraid to admit they were wrong, and they just let a bad position go against them. So there's all of these things, and investing and trading, it is first and foremost managing risk. Do Yep. not allow a bad position to go against you. Do not allow capital impairment. Do not allow permanent capital impairment. That's the worst thing, right? A temporary loss, no big deal. But when you buy something and it becomes truly impaired, you know, whether it's for fraud or from, you know, bad management or whatever it is, you just can't recover when your capital goes away. You can, you know, if you minimize your individual trading losses, you can recover. Because you're not going to be right all the time. That's one of the things, you know, you and I on Twitter, we get bombarded with these people. Oh, yesterday you said you loved, you know, Tesla. Now you say you hate it. Well, yeah, because the facts changed. So I changed my mind. And I could love something and be totally wrong, but then I changed my mind and you know, stop being long and actually go short. That's the nature of great investors. Say good investors sell or cover. Right, they sell something they're long, or they cover something they're short. Great investors go short or go long, reverse the position. That's the difference between really good investing and great investing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. That's why it's not always the smartest person who becomes the greatest trader. It's somebody who really can forget about losses. I mean, for me, it's always been about healing. You know, you have a loss, you move on, be willing to move on, be willing to be wrong, and have the flexibility to, you and I had a different conversation, or we had a conversation aside from today, when we were talking about how I could read a bearish piece and a bullish piece, and I just want to take my opinion out of it. I want to watch both of them or read both of them, and then I go in and I make my own judgments. And I'm very flexible. I don't care if I'm long or short any one particular market. I just want to be on the right side of it.
It's so important. And look, there are a couple things you said there that are so brilliant about this business. Is one, yeah, I got the privilege to spend some time with Coach K, and you know, one of the greatest coaches, maybe the greatest basketball coach that's ever lived. And he had a great line. He said, you know, what separates the average player, the substitute trader or investor in there, from the greats is that the average player focuses on the last play. And the great player focuses on the next play. I mean, how many times do you see a guy miss a shot and then go down and commit a stupid foul because he's thinking about missing the shot? Same thing with a trader or investor. If you're constantly thinking about the mistake you made, you're not focused on the future. You're not focused on the next investment or trade. And then the second thing about this is that ultimately, you know, what we're trying to do is multiply capital. And you can do it being long, you can do it being short, you can change your mind. And in this business, you're not going to be right the majority of the time. You know, yeah, if you're lucky, you get to be right 51, 52. The legends, Soros, Robertson, Steinhardt, 58%. That's it. And so you got to be able to admit when you're wrong and truncate your downside. And then, as you said, heal quickly, or as I say, instant erasure. You just have to instantly erase the past and focus on the future.
Yeah, I could talk to you all day about this, but we've got some great topics to talk about. And I want to begin by talking about equity valuations and the risk to investors, because anyone that's heard you speak or tweet knows that you really have strong feelings on this. So, Mark, I'm going to give the floor to you. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, like my wife says, I'm frequently wrong, but never in doubt. I like to say I'm occasionally wrong, never in doubt. But I do have strong views, and I take such grief over it. People say, well, how can you say things so strongly? People might believe you. I'm like, that's actually kind of the idea. But the key is that if you don't have a view, if you don't take a strong view, how do you ever act? If you don't have conviction, well, And hubris is different than conviction, right? Hubris is when you have arrogance about something that you haven't done the work, you don't have any knowledge, you don't have any edge. If you've done the work and you have high conviction in something, and then you have the humility to say, hey, if you're wrong, you can change your mind, that's how you win long term. But valuations today, as I said, many people have seen me, and I was just quoted the other day. I gave a speech down at John Malden's event down in Florida. And, you know, I talked about Roger Babson and how Roger Babson warned in 1927 that the market was overvalued. Then he warned again in 1928 that it was overvalued. And then he warned again in 1929, and he said, I repeat what I said last year and the year before, that we're going to have a correction and it could be terrific. And I qualified saying, well, what he meant by that was it could be massive. And that's what they put in the Business Insider journal article. So they said that, you know, Mark Yusko is predicting a massive crash. And basically what I'm saying is that Roger Babson was right, and that he wasn't wrong in 27, he wasn't wrong in 28. And the fact that the market gets more overvalued, okay, doesn't make you wrong. It's moving away from fair value or intrinsic value. It just means you're early. There's a difference. And so the key is that, yeah, the market has been overvalued for a while. The fact that it keeps getting more overvalued doesn't mean anyone who said it was overvalued a year ago was wrong. It just means the market continues to move up, and it does this. It gets emotional, and we've seen it in 2000. We've seen it in 2008, and I think we're reaching another time. I happen to think it's very similar to 1929 when you look at valuation and politics and social mood. And there's this guy, Neil Howe, who talks about this, that every fourth generation is very similar. And so we have a very similar generation today to the generation we had in the 1930s. And I think if you look around, both in terms of social mood, social relationships, politics, everything is very similar to the 1930s. We had zero interest rates in the 1930s, just like today. We had, you know, militarization, so to speak, in terms of healing from the World War I, just like in the 1930s. So I think we're having all these things. And then on top of it, we had Hoover come into power with a Republican sweep, making all these big promises. And the market believed those promises at face value and went ballistic and went to levels of valuation that it had never seen, the highest since 1860. And I think we're reliving that. You know, Trump comes into office, the market's rallied since then, it's believing all these promises, it's not paying attention to fundamental valuation. And here's the crazy thing. Earnings today are the same as they were in 2012. Okay, we've gone 5 years with no increase in earnings, yet the market's up 70%. How did it do that? Well, PE ratios went up, multiples went up. So we're at a point today where in the U.S., I believe valuations are not as stupid as 2000, but I joke that's like saying to the officer when he pulls you over for DUI, and I guess it's funnier now that Tiger just had that happen, that the officer pulls you over and say, well, officer, I'm not as drunk as the guy in the back seat passed out. Someone had to drive. No one has to drive. You do not have to be invested here. you can be in cash. Cash is king. You do not have to buy assets at the second highest valuation of all time.
Couple things. Number one, you talked about just because markets continue to go higher doesn't mean you're wrong. They become more overvalued. I know in my career, now I'm a short-term trader, I think good traders are always early. I think they see things happening beforehand, and that's why it always comes down to execution. So my question to you is, if things start to happen, how do you execute and take advantage of this? Like, what will all of a sudden be a trigger that you're like, okay, I should start executing this way, or maybe you already are, to where you start taking advantage of that?
Yeah, look, I think great investors, traders in this business understand the value of the things that they buy and sell, right? They understand what the intrinsic value is. And to buy, you want to buy below intrinsic value. You want to have a margin of safety, as Ben Graham talked about. And I've written long letters about this. You can find them out on the internet. If you just Google Morgan Creek letters, they'll pop up. And I wrote one on Sir John Templeton. I wrote one on Julian Robertson. I wrote one on George Soros. Recently, I wrote one on Seth Klarman, one of the kings of value investing. And then the most recent one I wrote was about Ben Graham. And, you know, Roger Babson, which I wrote about 2 quarters ago, had this belief. He was basically obsessed with Sir Isaac Newton and gravity. And he said that, you know, gravity rules. And if there's just a way we could defeat the powers of gravity, he spent, you know, the last 2 decades of his life trying to find a way to defeat gravity, which was kind of crazy. But if you think about the way it works, is markets get to a point where they become reflexive and they become self-fulfilling and they move away from fair value. And I think that's the, you know, where we are today. If you look at the FANGs, for example, you know, the FANG stocks are up $260 billion since March 1st. The rest of the market, the other 495 stocks, are down $260 billion, which means we're flat since March 1st. That's not a good, healthy market. And so what you need to do in that environment is you need to raise cash. So if you look at Seth Klarman, he's got lots of cash. If you look at Warren Buffett, he's got lots of cash. If you look at Julian Robertson, he's got lots of cash. Look at George Soros, he's got lots of cash. So one thing is you start to raise cash as things move away from fair value. The second thing you do is you search, you know, high and low for value. And I think there are some places around the world where there's some value. There's some value in peripheral Europe. There's some value in emerging markets. There's some value in energy and healthcare in the U.S. I don't think all sectors are overvalued in the U.S. But you start looking for value. So the process of raising cash, you know, preparing yourself to buy assets on the other side of the correction, and something I believe wholeheartedly is what Sir Isaac Newton said, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So the bigger the bubble, the bigger the bust, the bigger the crash.
You mentioned some value areas, and there's this emerging narrative that Europe is now a safe place to invest. And, you know, I have some questions about this because with all the geopolitical concerns going on over there, the uncertainty of the future of the European Union, I know that that's kind of been put on hold a little bit with Macron winning. But, I mean, from a trader's perspective, too, you've also got a euro that's stabilized. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not really the best thing for European equities. And you've seen the euro stocks really pretty good over the past year. So, Mark, please give us your thoughts on why this emerging narrative that Europe is a safe place to invest.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to your point. I mean, you made a lot of great points. I mean, one is, you know, starting in July of last year, you basically had this rally in Europe because, you know, Draghi came out and said, whatever it takes again. And they were going to push rates from negative to positive, and they've been relatively successful, although they still have some negative rates over there, which is just, you know, anathema to the banking industry and the insurance industry. Yet, you know, stocks have rallied. You know, the European markets are up way more than the U.S. since July of last year. And if you bought European financials, which everybody had thrown out baby with the bathwater, they're up a lot. I mean, huge, 45-50+% and some even more. And in places like Greece, which I think we'll talk about at some point. But what's crazy is that if you look at Europe today, after this big move, yes, the EU breakup is a little bit off the table today. And yes, the Euro breakup is a little bit off the table. I like to call it Hotel Cal EU-fornia, which is basically you can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. What people don't understand about the Euro and the EU and the Euro is it was created by Germany so that they could be mercantilist, right? If they had to use Deutschmarks today, it'd be 40% higher, and they wouldn't sell as many BMWs and Mercedes and Porsches and machine tools. So they want a weak currency. So your point about the euro strengthening, that's worrisome to them because they are the most mercantilist people on the planet. They basically survive by manipulating their currency and selling cheap goods around the world. So they don't want a strong euro, and that's why they keep Greece and other countries in the euro, because they want all the crappy countries in so the euro is weak so they can have, you know, better mercantilism. So the challenge for Europe today is I can see the positive or the bullish argument that everyone in the world is underweight Europe because they were worried about, you know, Le Pen winning in France and the Netherlands right, far right, and all the things that could have happened to bust up the EU. Now that that hasn't happened, everybody in the asset management business has got to start buying European assets. That's bullish for the euro because they got to convert to euro to buy the assets. So all in all, the Eurostoxx 600 is trading at 24, 25 times earnings. That doesn't seem very cheap to me. I think there are places in the periphery, in the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, where there are some pockets of value, Spain in particular, Greece in particular. But I just think that Europe as a blanket statement that it's safe, it's safer, but I still think you have to be disciplined.
Yep. Now, you took a trade and you went long Greek banking stocks. You picked some names. I don't know what they are. Maybe you can mention some of them. And it turned out to be a really, really good trade. And you were onto that early.
Well, to be fair, I was too early. So, you know, I was there a couple of years ago before the second recap, and I had to take my losses. And that was one where it turned out I was wrong. But now, post that, as of, you know, earlier this year in February, it appeared that they were going to get the third bailout. Everything, you know, negotiations with the EU and the Troika were looking good. And so, you know, we looked at Alpha Bank and Piraeus Bank and National Bank of Greece and what am I missing? Oh, and Eurobank. And we bought a basket of those, and we've done quite well over the last few months, and I think are going to continue to do well. Because I think they are going to get their bailout here in June, July, and everything's going to proceed. Now, is there a lot of, you know, recovery that still has to happen in Greece? Absolutely. But interestingly, for a guy that everybody hated 3 years ago, Tsipras has done a very good job bringing Syriza from the far right closer to the middle. He's actually, you know, he has a goal to be the JFK of their generation. It's a pretty audacious goal. We'll see if it happens. But I think it's an interesting play.
And now you say emerging markets are the best place for equity investors, but you do say that there is a nuance. Talk to us about that.
Look, you know, long term, over the next decade, do I think emerging markets, developing markets are going to crush the developed world? Absolutely. Look, I think the developed world, you know, US, Europe, Japan are going to be low single digits at best for the next decade, compounded. But I think emerging markets could compound close to 10. Why? Well, it's valuation. They're much, much cheaper. They trade at 12 times instead of 24 times. The growth is much better. The GDP growth is better, which means the profit growth is going to be better. And you've got liquidity at your back because they can cut interest rates rather than having to hike interest rates in a tightening cycle. So all the things are pointing to emerging markets. Now, the nuance is that the world doesn't understand developed markets versus emerging markets in the same way that maybe you and I might, in sense of they still view emerging markets as risky and developed markets as safe, despite the fact that emerging markets are priced more for, you know, not safety, and emerging markets are priced for safety because they're growing faster than their PE, their growth rate's faster than their PE. So, you know, there are assets around the world in some countries that are selling at low single-digit PEs. And there are countries like Argentina where the equitization rate, meaning the market cap of the market divided by GDP, is 13%. It's 130% in the U.S. 70 is where you start to get to fair value. So we think both of those ratios are going to go the other way. But the nuance is, in the short run, if people view emerging markets as risky, what's going to happen if my Welcome to Hooverville, you know, plays out in the U.S. and the U.S. market has a crack in the fall, well, emerging markets are going to fall too. And so short term, I'm nervous. You know, we've been overweight emerging markets. It's been great for our clients. It's been great for us. It's been great for our BRIC Plus fund. You know, those markets are up 20% year to date. Our some of our accounts are up even more than that. You know, the places that had more exposure to Greece and Argentina, which are up in the 40s and 50s. But as a good value investor, I want to be selling into that strength, raising some more cash, and then trying to buy in it at a better price in the fall.
All right. You just mentioned that equities might take a crack in the fall, and you've been talking about chances of a recession in the U.S. growing. And I know that you were talking about this on Twitter, and somebody had went out there and said, hey, it's great to call this, but when do you think it's going to happen? And you just threw out a month, and you said, yeah, September. And you and I were laughing about this, and we talked about this a little bit early in the show today, too. That's just your view. You know, argue with you about the view. We all know that you could change your mind. And right now, I know that you've been thinking that maybe September isn't the month that this may potentially happen. But talk to us about why you have this view in general of chances of a recession in the U.S. closer than we may think.
Yep. So a couple things. So there's two things that go in here. One is recession. You know, we're at the tail end of the economic cycle. Nobody could argue that. It's the third longest economic cycle in history. By January, it'll be the second longest. And look, the Fed has not eradicated the business cycle. We're going to have another recession. It's just a matter of when, not if. A couple of things happened last year, over the last 2 years, that may have pushed it from happening. It should have happened 17, 18, by all cyclical means, and there are a lot of indicators pointing to that. The ISM was falling. It actually got even under 50 early last year, so you could even argue that we were starting to contract. But then what happened is oil prices fell so much that the consumer got a lift, similar to what happened in the mid-80s, and you got a mid-cycle correction instead of a true recession, and that extended the economic cycle back in the mid-80s into 91 before you had the next recession after the 83 recession. So I think that's possible that happened here and that we don't get something until later this year into the beginning of next year. That said, the reason I think that September and the fall is a dicey time for equities is, you know, we believe that you know, Trump, like Hoover, was only the third president ever elected with no experience, just like Hoover had no experience. And basically what happened is the Republicans swept in 28 in November, and everybody got excited, and the market started to rally. And, you know, that's on the tail end of this, you know, roaring 20s, and people started levering up, and you got this bubble peak in the first week of September. And that's equivalent to the S&P being 2,800. So we're 2,400 today. If we rallied through the summer to 2,800, that would be, to me, very equivalent to 1929. And if you look at you know, we've got all-time record levels of margin debt. We had $2.5 trillion, with a T, trillion, borrowed by corporations to buy back stock. That's very similar to leverage, just like the leveraged purchasers in what we're called investment trusts back in the 1929 bubble. And so all these things are so similar. And so I think, you know, September, October, November, I don't care what month it is, but September is when it happened in 29. And what's interesting is it started down, and Roger Babson warned mid-September, you know, the market could have a correction. It could be terrific. But then what happened is Irving Fisher came out on October 15th and said, no, the market has reached a new permanently higher plateau and that Babson's just a bear and he's wrong. You know, when people hate you, they call you a bear. It's so funny. It happens on Twitter all the time. And basically Fisher said stocks couldn't go down. Oops, down 86% from there. So whether September, October, November, it doesn't matter. And, you know, there's a funny line that says a good economist tells you what or when, never together. So I said that, yeah, I thought there could be a correction. And then somebody said, oh, but put a date on it. I'm like, well, I did write a very long letter, 91 pages to be exact, on why I thought it could happen this fall. But whether it's September, October, November, I don't really have any idea.
Now, last topic before we get into rapid fire questions. I can't go a show these days without talking about oil. It's funny, oil seems to have more eyes and opinions on it than even equities or bonds these days. And it's funny for me, growing up as an S&P trader, that was all the talk when E-mini S&P came around. I mean, everything was E-mini S&P. Now it just seems to be shifted more to oil. Everybody you talk to on the street also wants to know about the price of oil. Now, you have an outlook on oil. which has a direct impact on earnings. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, look, everybody loves oil. You know, everybody's day trading triple leveraged oil ETFs or ETNs. God forbid they buy these stupid ETNs that have a negative roll yield of 20% that people just don't understand. Backwardation and contango, whole nother topic for another day. But, you know, oil is on everybody's minds. Everyone talks about it every day on the talking heads on TV. And so everybody's worried about it. And there are a lot of people that got very bullish about oil when OPEC said they were going to cut production. And our view is that it just wasn't going to happen. You know, one, you know, cartels cheat. So we saw a little bit of that this morning. Second is what people didn't realize is that the shale, you know, Saudi thought they could kill off shale if they got prices down below 70. Well, it turns out shale has got found a way to get oil out of the ground at $25, $30. So now U.S. production is ramped almost to offset the Saudi cuts. So oil prices are going to be weak. We think lower for longer. The reality is that if you look historically, oil prices tend to be highly correlated with S&P earnings. S&P earnings tend to be correlated with S&P stock prices. So if oil prices stay down in the 40 to 50 range, that's going to put pressure on this big recovery, quote unquote, that was happening to earnings. You know, I loved it last year, but he said, well, earnings aren't that bad, ex energy. I'm like, really? You're going to take out energy because that's where the bad stuff is. Well, he didn't say ex financials in 07 or ex technology in 00, or maybe people did, but it's just stupid. Well, this year, all the recovery in earnings has come from oil and energy. Well, now they're not saying ex energy anymore. So, you know, we think that earnings growth is going to slide. We think the ISM is going to roll over because inflation's going away. And there was this 1 year recovery in oil prices that filtered into CPI. CPI is now going to collapse back sub 2. That's going to push ISM down into the low 50s, maybe even sub 50. We're going to be closer to recession. That's going to decrease demand for oil. That's going to put pressure on oil prices. We're going to stay in the 40s or 50s. That means, you know, ugliness all the way around.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the domino effect from that, as I know that you watch pretty much everything. If equities start to get hit, what do you think happens in the treasury market and the dollar?
Well, I'm one of the last dollar bears, I think, in the world. You know, we thought the dollar peaked in early 15. It was at 100. It did get up to 103, but now it's in the 90s. And we think it's been in secular decline since 71. It's had three cyclical peaks, and we think it's going to continue down from here. We also think that in terms of treasuries, look, I think the secular low in interest rates are in 21, 22. I follow Lacey Hunt on this from Van Huysington. And, you know, I think buying long treasuries here, I think by the end of this year, long treasuries, TLT, will outperform SPX. And I think not very many people believe that, and they think rates are going to go up. I think we're stuck in deflation for a long time, you know, with the killer D's of too much debt, bad demographics, and deflation. That's going to put pressure on rates. Rates are going to go down, and it's just demographics. You can't make people suddenly be young. You know, every day in this country, 10,000 people turn 65. 65-year-olds don't buy a lot of stocks. They buy bonds. And that's going to put pressure on treasuries. So we like treasuries. We don't like the dollar. We think oil is going to be stagnant, and we're you know, we think the last domino in that is the S&P.
Yeah, we talk about being early as a trader. Look at what's happening right now in treasuries so far this year. They've basically opened up and slowly grinded higher. Not what you would expect a year to where the Fed is raising rates.
Correct.
Yep. So great stuff today, Mark. Are you ready for our rapid fire segment?
Bring it.
All right, everyone, our Rapid Fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Trade the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT, the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. First question, how has your trading evolved over the years?
You know, I think the biggest evolution has been my appreciation for risk management and taking care of the losses. You know, when I was young, just like everybody else, I thought it was all about making money. It was all about the big idea. And then I just got slaughtered so many times. The second thing, evolution-wise, is the idea of falling knives. You know, everybody likes to try to catch the knife when it's falling. And I lost a few fingers, and I finally realized, let the knife hit the ground, bounce around a little bit and stop moving, then go pick it up. So don't try to anticipate, let the trend change. And that goes back to, you know, Soros's wise words that, you know, everyone thinks you want to be against the trend. No. You want to trade or invest with the trend, except at inflection points. And that's where you want to be very careful. But the nice thing is the inflection points tend to tell you when they're going to happen because the volatility increases, kind of like how atoms start shifting very rapidly right before they change from water to steam.
Yep. It reminds me of R. Cashin's line, second mouse gets the cheese.
Exactly.
Can you tell me the moment that trading just clicked for you?
Oh, yeah. The first time I watched something go to zero. And what's cool about it is my broker leaves those on your statement. So every time I open my statement, I see the Coho Energy stock that I just held and held and held. And I realized that you have to be active. You have to admit when you're wrong, and you have to move on and focus on the future, not the past. And that's when I finally realized you don't have to make the money back the same way you lost it. So many people think you have to make the money back in the same security. No, just move on to the next good idea.
What's the number one source you spend your time on?
It's funny. I hate to say it because it sounds so trite today, but it's Twitter. I mean, my wife says I'm addicted to it. I love it. I get such great news information. I get such public opinion, contrarian, so I can make contrarian views based on the world. The traditional media outlets are just too slow. You know, I can find out if I want to know what's going on with the Argentinian election, I can do hashtag Argentine election and I can see live streams of what's going on with Mr. Macri. It's incredible. So I spend a lot of time with that. And then I read a lot. I mean, you know, I love what Raoul Paul does. I know he's been on your show. I love what he does. I love Jeremy Grantham's letters. I love 13D Research, Kirill Sokolov. I think he's a seer. He's on Twitter as well. So that's what I learned this week. Lots of good stuff out there.
What's your favorite book about trading or the markets?
My favorite book of all time is The Dow Jones Averages, and that's spelled T-A-O. It's out of print. You got to buy it on, I hate to plug Amazon since I think they're overvalued, but you got to buy it on Amazon used books. But it's a merger of Eastern Chinese philosophy and investing, written by Bennett Goodspeed. And it's one of the best things about investing that I've ever read. It talks about how you have to have the guts to trust your gut, how you have to use your whole brain, both your analytical right brain or left brain, as well as your artistic or creative or intuitive right brain. That's one of the reasons they say women are better investors because they have more balance in their brain. Us guys tend to be all right-handed and analytical, so we go right off the curve as the road turns because we're looking in the rearview mirror. So Dow Jones Averages, and the second, the right close behind that is actually a book by Harry Dent called The Great Boom Ahead, which really talks about demographics and S-curves. You know, his other books after that, people don't like him, but his first book, The Great Boom Ahead from 1993, is amazing.
What's your favorite movie or TV show about trading or the markets?
It's so current, but Billions. I love Billions. I think it's so well written. I think Andrew Ross Sorkin is a genius. Love that show. I love Axe. I love the characters. I love Giamatti's acting, Damian Lewis. And plus, it's cool when I watch it to say, wait, I know that guy. I know that trade. I know, wait a minute, I did that. I lost money on that, or I made money on that. It's just absolutely transfixing. So cool.
What's the best piece of advice you've received about trading or the markets?
Probably the best piece of advice is to invest without emotion. To try to focus on, you know, being analytical and disciplined and follow your process. The first two guys I worked for, the professors at Northwestern, they had these coffee mugs that had that emblazoned on them, invest without emotion. Most of us are ruled by our emotions, and it makes us make bad decisions.
Now, if you can give a piece of advice to the new people interested in getting involved in trading, what would it be?
Trade. Just do it. And learn from your mistakes. And actually, that's not really the best advice. The best advice? Get a great mentor. And it doesn't have to be a physical person. You can get a mentor from a book. You know, pick up Jack Swager's Market Masters or, you know, any of his books he's written and just read about great traders and great investors. Read about Paul Tudor Jones. Read about Julian Robertson. Read about George Soros. And look, I write these long letters about people I idolize and admire. And doing that process of digging into their lives, they're great mentors for me. So get a great mentor. And focus on deliberate practice. Find something that you're good at and that you like, and deliberately practice it over and over using that great coaching and that great mentorship, and you'll become a great trader or investor.
Now, if you weren't a trader, you'd be doing what?
Well, I'd be a fly fishing guide. I love to fly fish. I love the or ski guide, but I'd probably be a fly fishing guide. I just I love the hunt. I think it has a lot of similarities to investing, actually, in terms of all the things you have to do to prepare and you know, find the great, find the fish, and you got to match the hatch. And so I would, plus fish don't live in ugly places.
No, that's so true. And it's so funny. I think a lot of us, because we're at the screens all the time, we're always reading, we always want to do something that's not in front of computers all the time. And so mine was always going to be, I wanted to be a professional golfer, just so I could be outside all the time and not at these screens all day. So Mark, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed this today. It was awesome. It was great to finally be able to get a chance to speak with you. I've been following you for a while. Great insight today. Where can people find you on Twitter and learn more about what you're doing at your company, Morgan Creek Capital?
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed this conversation. Really a lot of fun. I'm at Mark Yusko. That's at MarkYusko. And we're also at Morgan Creek Cap. CAP.com. Look forward to connecting with people. And again, really enjoyed our time together today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show. And I look forward to having more conversations with you in the future.
Sounds great.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.